This is Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with a man I've had a number of conversations with on the air and off, but not in a while. He came through town to visit in Baltimore to run a weekend, a retreat, and to talk at Kol Halev, which is a progressive synagogue here in Baltimore. Roger Kamens is his name. Roger is the author of a book called The Jew and the Lotus, where we first met a good 17 years ago when he wrote this book, and we met after that. He's written The History of Last Night's Dream. Burnt Books is his latest book. Reb Nachman of Bratislava and Franz Kafka. He's a poet, writer, thinker, man who works in dreams, and he's here in our studio today. And Roger, good to see you, man. It's been a long time.
Good to see you, Mark, really. Fantastic.
It is good to see you.
Great to be here with you.
So, you've got this body of work. So I said to you when you were coming to Baltimore, I said, we've got to have you come to the studio to talk. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to wrestle with this idea of what is this arc of Roger's work? You know, what is it for all these years?
Yeah.
And I was reading Jew and the Lotus. I told you I was rereading some of it last night.
Yeah.
And I thought that this, for you, besides being a book that puts you out there, it's a book that you grab the public.
Yeah.
It also is the beginning to me, it seems to me, of your spiritual journey.
True.
This meeting of these Jewish thinkers, some rabbis, and the Dalai Lama and other Tibetan Buddhists.
Right.
But it took you on a journey that you weren't sure where it was going to take you, but it opened
right.
a new path for you then.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Yeah, because I think it was an event. I mean, when I look at it now, I believe that, you know, I understood the event kind of in the horizontal
mm-hmm.
where we live. And so you could see it that way as a dialogue relationship between, you know, this leader in exile seeking advice from exile experts on how to survive in exile, which is the way he framed it rather beautifully. But and then also seeing and maybe feeling for the first time that there was more to life than you know, the horizontal plane of relationship, of growth, you know, education, career, that the way we frame life, in a way we understand life in the horizontal, what Jung calls the spirit of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And then only now maybe beginning to sense, okay, it's also certain events. I mean, I did sense it then. I wrote about it that way. That certain events are paradigmatic. They are vertical events. They are moments of, you know, some people would say transcendence, but they could also say they're moments of depth of meaning. So there are certain encounters, especially the one between Rabbi Zalman Schachter and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, where
just a quick digression for folks who don't know.
Sure.
Zalman Schachter is a very mystical Jewish Rebbe in America
right.
who grew up in an Orthodox home, but is not traditional Orthodox. He's a very kind of different thinker.
Right.
Yeah. So just
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a man of mystical depth in a time of spiritual flatness. And obviously the Dalai Lama is a guy who is both in the historical plane as a leader of his people in the struggle with Tibet and a vertical guy in the sense that he is taking us deeper into the possibility of realizing that we're really more than just robots or,
mm-hmm.
you know, career rockets or whatever.
Right.
You know, up and down, you know, like, oh, I'm crashing, you know, like
right,
that deal,
right,
you know,
right.
Oh, I'm doing so well, I'm flying up, and now I'm crashing, you know, that whole up
the
and down.
The manic existence that is existence.
Right. But it isn't. It isn't. That's
but
the
that
truth
bit,
is
right.
It's not the true existence, which is actually about the soul and its development. So realizing that, I mean, Reb Zalman saw his encounter with the Dalai Lama as an encounter of souls. I mean, he already understood that. I don't think any of the rest of us really did. We thought we were meeting this really cool guy who had a great palace and, you know.
Oh, meet the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, meet the Dalai Lama. Wow, you know, and wouldn't I like to meet him too? And what was he like? And, you know, what coffee does he drink? So can I get him to endorse my blue jeans? You know, like. Something singular did happen that was mind-blowing. That I knew because when I came home, I was babbling incoherently and I was meditating and I was discovering all this stuff. If it hadn't happened in me, it couldn't have happened in the book.
And to me, it was from reading the book and reading some of the stuff you wrote 6 years later after you went back to see him with your book and this film crew.
Right.
The Jew and the Lotus.
Yes.
It was as if what that meeting did was to make you, for your understanding was that for Judaism, growing up as a Jew, that it was beyond just this prayer stuff that you do in the family and the places people go to find themselves culturally or historically as a
identity.
Jew. Identity. That it was this kind of spiritual, unwritten kind of thing. That not in the word, that was to change the way you could explore who you were.
Right. I mean, I think as we grow, whatever tradition we're birthed into or non-tradition these days and often, but whatever that is, we find an identity there, either and you end up with these personalities attached to identities in this really rigid way. You know, you end up with Rick Santorum or something. I mean, not that he's not a great guy, but he's not. But you do. But my point isn't about, and it's not about the particular version of, say, Christianity or Judaism that ends up being so combative in its personality and so involved in the fight with the enemies, real and imagined.
Mm-hmm.
Which becomes identity. Right. I'm this because I'm not that, right? And so that sense of identity is very horizontal also, isn't it? It's relational in the plane of so-called waking reality.
Mm-hmm.
But the deeper meaning of what these traditions are trying to get at has nothing to do with that.
There was something – I hope I wrote this down. Maybe I didn't. But if I did, I'm going to read it. Something you said after you saw the Dalai Lama that time. Here it is. This is it. I think this is it. You said, for me being this, I don't know if you said in the book or one of the things that you wrote later, but you said, for me being Jewish was wrapped up in our collective history, my family, my identity, which you were just talking about.
Right.
I had never before considered Jewishness as a spiritual path.
Right.
That was to me that.
Right.
That quote really hit me.
Right. So that's right, because we could go through the rituals and for me, it was a family thing, actually. It was more like, my grandfather having all the aunts and uncles over and then the 14 grandchildren running around the house and going down the laundry chute and, having fun and the joy of that. And that was really hugely what it was about for me.
Right.
And loving that. So one of the great things that happened to me as a child is I did come out of childhood with a very positive feel of that. I never felt some Jews feel shame or something around their identity. I never felt that ever. It doesn't even resonate for me. I've never felt even anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know some Jews, unfortunately, do feel that. So that was good because in a way that's liberating. Well, I don't have any shame there at all. I just okay, this is what I am, take it or leave it, but so, and then what? So then the bigger question is, and then what? So what? Okay, I'm a Jew, what's the big deal? Well, I'm a Jew, I'm a potato, whatever, I'm that thing. So that's where you have to, so it wasn't until this meeting really where I began to see two traditions, two peoples using their soul, their depth, to deal with stuff happening in the present, especially the Dalai Lama. I mean, just, exile, the pain of exile, the loss, the continual struggle, always informed by his practice of, in his case, of meditation and visualization. That was key. So that for the first time, it kind of occurred to me that religion wasn't just about identity. It was actually about touching a deeper place inside you so that you always came to whatever problems you have with that depth.
It was almost as if, now this is important to think about in terms of the other works that you've written that I've read, like some of your books of poetry and your dream book and this latest book on Kafka and
Nachman.
And Nachman.
Yeah.
Is that it was as if that moment for you
unlocked
the rigidity of what the body of religious work means to being a Jew. You could have done it as a Catholic. You could have done it as any religion in the world.
Absolutely.
But that their approach, their meditation, their looking at spirituality beyond ourselves and thinking something without looking at a God, but looking at something that's kind of
right.
vast among us.
Right.
That's what you – something clicked and set you on this path that actually may have opened up the dream work
right.
and the Nachman Kafka work.
Right. Well, I think that whatever work we do, like the work you do, if it's informed by your soul, I mean it's coming from a genuine place in you, then it comes out in the way you do your work. And, you know, I think unlocked, unclicked is probably the sense of it, of mm-hmm. relaxation, because the thing about being in the world of identity, the us and the them, you know, the world of two. The rabbis call it the world of two. Quite, you know, that they say, you know, we live in the world of two. You know, the Garden of Eden, where you eat that tree of right and wrong. Now I know good from evil. Well, good and bad, male and female, or black and white in every sense of the word, or Jewish and not Jewish. That world of drama of distinctions mm-hmm. that engages us is anxiety provoking. It's probably anxiety-provoking because no matter which position you take, you know you're missing something underneath.
Right.
There is a place underneath where those distinctions actually have a root. And when you get to that place, then you realize how much energy and libido you're wasting on the fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really, yeah, just to meditate and –
which is hard
which I don't do. I'm not a meditator. You know, don't tell anybody. But I don't.
You just told everybody.
Yeah. Well, whoever's listening. I don't. Personally, I think it's great. It was great for me to do it and to stop all that. That was just the beginning. But, you know, by the way, it's only taken me 20 more years to get a little bit further. So, but for me, meditation ended up not being, like, I didn't want to stay in that place. It really was more, like you said, an unclenching.
Mm-hmm.
So that I could begin to explore, begin to go deeper. You know, so the meditation didn't work for me, and that's where I got into the dreams. So
and the dream stuff was interesting. That the last time I did interview for that book.
Yes, you did. How nice of you.
My pleasure.
It was fun.
It was a good. And it was a good book. It is a good book. And so
yes,
the history of last night's dream.
That's right.
And that book, again, to me was like. This watching this kind of as I was thinking about the arc of your work and trying to read a little bit of that again last night and trying to connect these dots. And maybe they're not all connected, but
probably not.
Probably not. but do me a favor, just for our listeners who yeah. can go on our web and we'll have all the interviews near each other so they can see the other things we've talked about in the past.
Right.
But
right.
take us very briefly through the sequence of that book, the people you traveled through to get to your dream place. Because you walked through a number of people.
Oh, you're talking about the – yeah.
Yes.
So basically the history of last night's dream, you know, probably was initiated in part by the contact with Tibetans because they're so into dreams. They are a people of the dream. And it occurred to me that, well, you know, Jews are also a people of the dream because the archetypal dream book of the West is Genesis. And here we get these two dreamers, Jacob – who has a revelation dream, and Joseph, who has a dream that ends up getting him condemned to death.
Right, right.
And then from that, he becomes the dream interpreter. So I already began to get interested in that idea. So to begin with, I sought a dream teacher, visualization teacher, a woman named Colette in Jerusalem, and she was really great. But the basic thing was that she would give you her visualization for you to follow. And I guess there was something in me that said, well, what about the natural visualizations that I'm having every night? Why wouldn't I want to follow those? And actually, in a way, so that's where I got more into dreaming and started looking for a teacher later on. There was a big hiatus between that encounter and what happened, almost 5 years. But because I got real busy doing other stuff around the Jew and the Lotus, but when I got back to it, it was at a bottom. I'd reached another bottom. By the way, speaking of – Dora said about Kafka, he said he doesn't just go towards the bottom, he is at the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, so to be at the bottom, we all, there are times in our lives when we get at the bottom, which could be a really hard place. It can happen because you get knocked off your trajectory and your rocket crashes. Mm-hmm. Or it could happen in other ways. But so I was in that place, and that's when I began to look at the possibility of dreams to kind of revive. So I looked for a Tibetan teacher. I was going to talk to a Tibetan teacher who does dream yoga, and I met this guy, Mark Bregman, in Vermont instead, and he really appealed to me. I thought he was really direct, and he had something. I didn't know what it was, but he had something, and that began my work with him.
Because it had to, his work, it was really interesting, because I was thinking a lot about the idea that, that your dreams are there to guide you.
Right.
It's basically what he's, in a larger sense, what he's talking about, right?
Well, I would put it this way, that you know, it's hard to find the right language, because I don't know who I'm talking to. I mean, I know I'm talking to you, but through you, I'm talking
right.
others. So, and people have so much reactivity around language. Like, if you say God to one person, they love it. If you say God to another person, they totally turn off and freak out. I don't want to turn off.
No, I said guide.
I know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I know.
Okay,
I know. I know. But behind that, what's guiding you?
Right.
Right?
Gotcha.
You know, what's guiding? So, you know, I work with my clients. I work with Buddhists. I work with Jews. I work with devout Christians. I work with people who hate religion. It doesn't matter. But what happens in the dream is that the hardest thing for people to do is to accept being loved, which sounds weird. You'd think, wow, mm-hmm. I'm loved. That's great. It's really hard. It's extremely intensely vulnerable, and it raises every issue in you to be loved. To be approved of, we can handle. We're geared for that. In fact, that's the trick. That's the substitution. Instead of feeling loved, we feel approved of or disapproved of. You know, so it goes up and down, you know. Pride and shame.
Right.
So we get into that cycle. But to be loved from your soul, right, to know that in your essence you're loved, you know, some religions say that. I mean, all of them say that in some different ways. But to actually feel and know it, very hard to experience. Sometimes we get a glimpse of it in our relationships, we hope.
Mm-hmm.
We feel it for a moment, and then we jump away. It's too intense, or it's too scary, or it's too something.
You think that's at the bottom, that's part of the human condition. This is what we're afraid of, no matter where we are, whether we are living in Paris or some tribal culture
right.
in a village. You think that's part of what every human being struggles with?
I think so. I think it's the soul, actually, or what I'm calling soul, knows that something about that. The child knows something about it, and very often in dreams the soul appears as a little boy or a little girl, knows that it's love just for being. But as grown-ups, we want to be liked for our accomplishments. It's
right.
very different. It's just different. And some people are good at that, and they do get liked and approved of big time or small time or in between time, and other people are just miserable because I didn't get that, I'm not getting that, you know, I'm not getting enough of it, I got some of it, I want more of it, I got all of it and I still want more. You know, we know all that stuff, right? And so, but to feel that, and of course theoretically, you know, even the most, any kind of religion, Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, saying in different ways, you are loved. That's right, right?
Right.
You are loved not because you did something. You are loved because you're just loved, you know? And so dreams, I think, are another way, not the only way, but a really potent way to actually go through the journey and get all the stuff that's in the way of experiencing that. So if I wanted to frame it, rather than say guidance, I understand what you're saying, but it's not so much – it's orientation.
Mm-hmm.
To understand the fundamental orientation of the soul and its need for love and its capacity to receive that. Because once you receive that in a deep enough way, then you can give it in a much deeper way. Of course, we try to love the people around. We try to love our wives. We try to love our children. We try to love our friends. But the deeper we can go, the dreams give you a chance to go so deep with that. That it becomes – that's why we talk about archetypes. It becomes the pattern of love.
As you say, he writes about the animus and the anima.
We use that words, and they're neutral. The reason we use those words –
one male, one female?
Animus, male. Anima, female. It comes out of Jung. Jung uses it slightly differently. But I would just say those are – I think Mark Bregman was shrewd to pick those words because in a way they are foreign. And so they don't have all of this
– baggage.
You know, if I went to someone and, you know, and said what I really think that is, I would be denominating it, you know, and then I'd be in a denomination. And then people would back to their – horizontal stuff about, well, I'm not that, I'm this, so don't tell me that. So I try. That's why I love that language in part, because it doesn't have any baggage.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about in looking at this stuff you write in my dreams, I looked at a couple of emails we wrote each other about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, whenever that was, that had to do with dreams when you first started this book, and I write it back and forth.
Right.
Is that, that many cultures use dreams.
True.
Right? The Aboriginal people of Australia.
Yes.
Dreamtime and being this other world that's connected to someplace beyond us. Or in many native worlds, it's like that dreams have to do with being prescient about things that are going to happen.
Right.
Then you have the kind of more industrial model of Freud, who says, you know, our dreams are part of our sexual repression and working all those things out.
Right.
In our heads.
Right.
So, I mean, but one of the things I think that, to parse through that with you, because I think that you're, not necessarily Freud, more Jung, but you're combining that with some other stuff through Bregman that kind of brings the idea of a dream being integral to our existence.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Right. Wholeness. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think.
Not something weird we just do because we're asleep.
Right. So, I mean, you said use, and that's the right point, that we're not, you know, dreams have a use for acquiring depth, and that takes it out of the realm of, you know, you might say the science of dreaming. You know, there's a whole lot we've learned about the mechanics, so to speak.
Biologically, neurologically, how we
dream. Yeah, we're learning and learning about that. And we, I mean, certainly it's remarkable information that's somewhat irrelevant. Just like if you looked at the anatomy of the throat and the larynx, you could you'd see its functionality, but you could never have predicted singing.
That's good. I never thought about that. That's right.
Right. or what it means.
Uh-huh.
Or you could, well, you could look at the penis and the vagina, but, you know, and say, well, it's reproduction. But you could never, none of that tells you anything at all about what sex and intimacy mean to us. So we have lost that, though. We've gotten so stupid in our brilliance, in a way, you know, in our science, that we're starting to forget that the actual meaning of things is very different from their mechanical, you know, all the wonderful things we're learning about how they, quote, work.
Mm-hmm.
But they have nothing to do with this ancient idea that, you know, what's a dream for, like you say. So it's for exploring in imagery the depth. Really, that's really what it's for. So Freud got some parts of it right, but he kind of went in there with the wrong toolbox. He went in there with his mind and his authority. I try to point out in the book how, you know, I show how he's always Dr. Freud in the dreams. He can't open up to the vulnerability of a woman who just needs to be helped. You know, he's too medical.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't let go of that because he was too much a mama's boy to let go of it. You know? His mama loved that, you know, so he couldn't let go of it. And, you know, so anyway.
So for me, for you then, to talk about what it means to work with dreams.
Yeah.
Because I know, I know people who do dream work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Similar to, I think, the way you do it, or at least that you all attempt to do it.
Right.
So, but I think that, let's lay that out a bit more. I mean, what does it mean to work with dreams?
Yeah.
Maybe you have an example that's your dream, or a dream that somebody you can just, have you written about, talk about what came through a dream and what, and how you work with that. What does it mean to work with a dream?
Okay. So, dreams take us through, I mean, I think a basic thing to say about dreams is that they display feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And they give us some rich and vivid experiences of feeling that are fundamental. And a fundamental feeling goes to the core of who you are. Maybe in this lifetime you've never stood at the edge of a cliff and jumped off. Probably not.
Not to still be here talking with you.
Exactly. But in a dream you might.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're facing, see a lion charging at you. Be next to a lion that's not in a cage. Maybe you've had a dream like that, where you're really close to a lion. So it gives you a chance to feel into a fundamental feeling that takes you very deep, because to be right there with a lion, for instance, is to be in the presence of a sense of fear that turns into a sense of awe, right? So if such a creature appears in your dream, how do you handle it? I remember a dream I had once where way back, and the neighbors had a lion, and they had a little boy. And I went over there and I said, I really think it's against the rules in the neighborhood to have a lion that's not behind a fence. So I was having a reaction. So then you see this guy's reaction is really uptight. Like, they're fine with it. And there's a little boy there and he's fine with it. Who's not fine with it? Me. So here's the awesome. Here's, you might say, if you have religious language, the divine, the archetypal, the powerful. And my relationship to it, rules, zoning rules or something, It's not safe. And then there's the boy, and he's just there with the lion. So the goal of the work is for me to die and become the boy.
Hmm.
So that's a whole process, because first you see the boy, then you be the boy, as we say in New Orleans. You be the boy. Now, to be boy is to be soul. So to be boy is to be soul. And the boy is fine with the lion. And he's fine with the mother and father, who are the archetypal mother and father. They're fine. Who's the odd man out? Me. So what has to happen? Me and that uptight attitude and those reactions, they die. And there's a whole process of dying to self. Because in order for me to be the boy, someone's got to go. Guess who it is? It's this guy coming over and saying, it's not in the rules of the neighborhood to have lions in your backyard. So, and you sort of see, it works in so many different ways. It's a long journey, but I just want to suggest how a dream displays where you happen to be and what it's about. And often there's something in waking life, the ways in which I might be attached to rules as a way to control my fear, for instance. And then I would try to look for instances of my doing that in waking life, not around lions in the neighborhood, but something a little more normal. But then also that quality of the boy, just seeing him. I mean, I did the great thing in that dream, which was way long ago, was just to realize I recognized him. Something was a hole in my story. If the lion's so terrible and wrong, why is the boy okay with it? And what's that? So you begin to have an opening to a deeper sense. So what would it be like to live like the boy who can be with a lion rather than live like this grouchy guy who's worried about the rules,
I'm going to explore some more when we come back to this in just a second. But how do you remember your dreams? So many people have a hard time remembering dreams because if you don't wake up and go, there it is,
right,
write it down, they're gone because they're ephemeral in some ways.
Yeah, they're evanescent. Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, the different levels to answer that. I mean, the simple thing is just basically if you're using or making use or learning from your dreams, you're more likely to remember them. If you're not, you're less likely to, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not, they're a little more subtle. I mean, they're not going to, like, scream at you. And when they do, we get so scared, we call them nightmares. And then we want to forget them. What is our reaction? Let's forget that. You know, what do we do when we're, you have kids, you know, when they're young? What do you do around kids who have scary dreams? What do parents do? I was talking to a parent last night, and, you know, oh, you tell them, well, you know, don't be scared, it was just a dream, you know, instead of saying, okay, you dropped down a hole, it's really scary. What does that feel like? Like, did your heart pound? I mean, how'd you feel that? When do you feel like that when you're awake?
Have you ever done that with a kid?
That's what I would do. I don't have any. Right now I have a granddaughter, but right. She's only 3 months old. But when she gets a little older, if I had the chance, that's what I would do.
You would do that. If you say, let's say her parents went away and you were being grandparents and you took care of your grandchild and she had a dream. Was that how you would handle it?
I don't know, but I really want to think about how I would. But I think, I think the good thing to do is to acknowledge the dream as real. Because the danger of this other approach, what I would call amelioration, which is a normal parental reaction. It relates to how, let me follow this thread. I'll come back to that. But basically that I would try to say, wow, you have a – thanks for telling me about this feeling. And it's okay to have this feeling even though it's scary. Like you had a scary feeling and people do. And, you know, I have scary feelings. There are times when I feel that way. So I want you to know you and I are – together on this, we both get scared, and it's okay. Grown-ups get scared too. They don't like to admit it, but we get scared too, just like that. We get scared just like you did there. So you're not alone in that, and that's really different from saying to the child, you know, oh, poo-poo, don't look at that. And the way we handle feelings is to diminish them, ride over them, pretend they didn't happen, deny their reality. Yeah, I mean, I don't know the answer to your question because I haven't really had a chance to work with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling our gut answer, the way we usually act, is probably wrong.
I like this. It's very interesting. We're talking with Roger Kamenetz. Roger Kamenetz is coming through Baltimore and joined us in our studio here. His books, The June of the Lotus, where we first met in 1995, The History of the Last Night's Dream, we've been talking about, Burnt Books, Rabbi Nachman, Bratzlav, and Franz Kafka, his books of poetry and more. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. It's Mark Steiner. I'm here with Roger Kamenetz, who's come through Baltimore. He had a retreat over the weekend with some folks at a synagogue. He is speaking at spoke at Kol Lev, came through Breathe Books together to bring him here to Baltimore to have a conversation with his progressive synagogue and other folks here in town. We've known each other on and off over the years through his work, and he agreed to come by the studio to talk with us. He's here in our studio and written incredible books. The June of the Lotus is one that grabbed me first, The History of the Last Night's Dream, and Burnt Books. So the dream world is such a, I was just rethinking your book. I didn't reread The History of Last Night's Dream all over again, but I was just kind of playing with pieces of it before you came in, you know.
Sure.
One of the things that, again, struck me here is that human beings have always wrestled with their dreams. Every culture wrestles with their dreams in some way, at least the ones that are not afraid to, don't want to kind of put them in boxes. Or, as you said, when you have them, we'll forget about them. They're just dreams, and they don't mean anything. It's all right. Everything's okay. Or else it's about how you love your mother, and that's why you can't get along with your wife or whatever.
Right.
But people who make dreams part of their soul and part of their waking life, that they actually become part of your essence and being.
Right.
That's getting back to something very different.
Right.
As human beings.
Yeah. So one of the things we do when I work with people, and by the way, the people I'm connected with, North of Eden, they have a website called North of Eden.
What is that?
northofeden.com is Mark Bregman's group.
Oh, that's Mark Bregman's group.
And since we talked, they've been really training up more teachers because I'm kind of – I only take new people on just occasionally because it's just so hard. I don't have a room right now. But that's a good resource about the work and what Mark's bringing out there. But but what I want to say is that in this practice with people, we – relating to what you're saying, we give people homework. And the homework is usually a moment from the dream. And it's a moment – usually a moment of feeling. Sometimes it's a moment of reaction, but usually it's a moment of feeling. And it becomes an anchor. So that during the week when you're distracted by all the busyness, you take a moment and you go back down into this feeling moment in the dream. And it serves as an anchor into your depth and gives you a different perspective. So let's say, you know, I was working that dream around the lion, and maybe for the homework I would be with the lion, feel the fear. So I anchor into that. So then when something happens where my control is threatened in waking life, if I'm lucky, I say, oh, I'm in a reaction here like I was in the dream. I'm going to go back down, just face the lion for a moment, and then I'll respond. So that changes everything. You're now reoriented to my own depth instead of getting caught up in the horizontal where I'm projecting my fear onto whoever is busting up, you know, not doing things the way I want them to. Do you get what I'm saying?
I absolutely get what you're saying, yeah.
So that's the dream – that's one way you could use the dream as an anchor to remind you that you do have a depth instead of always having to be superficial in your reaction. To me, what I like about dreams is that everybody can use them to go to their depths without how you necessarily it becoming – maybe I'm just nervous about the idea of that myself, you know, because I do see things sometimes. And I would say that spooky things can happen because you're down there and maybe you see things you wouldn't see otherwise.
But it is explaining like, some of the depth of who you are and what you think and kind of wrestling with the kind of human being you are and how to keep growing as a human being.
Right.
You can use your dreams to do that is what you're talking about.
Right. And I think that the depths you can go to are really remarkable because you get – when you work with people for a while, you get to a place where you've kind of understood the pains and traumas of this life. And then you start having dreams where there are kinds of – traumatic experiences that are not in this life. That what I mean is that simply they don't fit inside the remembered biography that you have.
Right, right, right.
And yet their intensity is so powerful and disturbing and real to both the dreamer and to me as I hear it that they're definitely undeniable. So again, I don't want to be the parent saying, oh, that's not real because
it didn't
happen. So then what do you do with that? And that's been a real interesting opening to seeing that people seem to carry memories of traumatic events. It's almost like they're the ones that – I mean, if you think of, you know, those are the ones that would get carried because the worst moment is that moment of abuse or torture when the soul is utterly cut off. And that's intended to kill the soul. We know that, like a simple example, Inquisition. Right, people were tortured not only to punish them but to cut off their souls.
Right,
the Holocaust. I mean, it was more than just killing people; it was a way of killing their souls. So we understand that throughout history, there have been people who didn't just want to kill the body because they could have killed the body much more easily. They really wanted to kill the soul,
which is through torture.
Through torture, or yeah.
So a question, but I wanted to ask you a couple more things here. One of the things I think about, you're a respected poet as well. Well, you are.
Thank you.
So how has this dream work you've done fueled and changed your poetry?
Mm. Well, it's opened me up to the poets who are of the soul.
Who would they be?
Well, Walt Whitman.
Uh-huh.
So important. And I think we've totally overlooked Walt Whitman and misunderstand him as to who he is for us. You know, I was, you know, the Walt Whitman service area and the New Jersey Turnpike.
Right.
And, you know,
we're not talking about that, right?
You know, right. Yeah. Well, it's just an example of how we
exactly.
trivialize something. But but Whitman is one of these. He's a soul. He says, "I am the poet of the body, and I am the poet of the soul." And he understands that soul, that the question of democracy is actually a question about relationship between soul and body, that it's democratic. He says, you know, the soul and the body are of the same level. This is really, and you know, I am the poet of the body, and I am the poet of the soul. I am the poet of the man, and I am the poet of the woman. So, radical democracy is something to do with understanding the nature of the soul as embodied, which is what dreams are about, also. You know, and he has a poem, "The Sleepers," where he says, "I wander all night in my vision," and he's going to all these people who are asleep. It's like he's the dream, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He's the dreamer and the dream. So. Soul travel, how do we experience it? We experience it in dreams. We become different people. We experience to meet the dead in our dreams. So the possibility of becoming pure soul is something that he understands and acts for us in his poetry. I want to cite one line.
He says,
in 1855 in Leaves of Grass, he says, you know, agonies are one of my changes of garments. That's beautiful. Agonies are one of my changes of garments. I do not ask the wounded person how he feels. I myself become the wounded person.
Mm.
Well, that, and then he shows it. He shows this incredible passage where there's like a fireman whose chest is crushed, and he shows he's carried out of the building, and he's surrounded by his comrades, and then the light kind of dims, and he dies, and he just takes you there. And then again and again and again. And we know that he also lived this because he didn't just write it. You know, when his brother got hurt, or he thought he was hurt, he went to the hospital and he spent years during the Civil War tending to the wounded and watching them die and holding them and giving them gifts and little gifts of tobacco or sweets and writing letters. And so agonies are one of my changes of garments was something he lived. So... to me, he's really, really important. And, you know, that's such difference from the way poetry has become. Because I was one of these teachers of poetry, a creative writing teacher. My God. You know, so that's seeing poetry from the outside. Like, you know, you know, prove your vocabulary. Follow this model. Write a villanelle. This whole industry of teaching people to write poetry, you know, which is kind of crazy because, you know, right, you know, since the invention of the electric guitar, writing poems is like making buggy whips. I mean, you know, like what is the point, you know, really to only write poetry?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are we doing there? It becomes a really closed-in place, and most people don't like it. And in a way, they're probably right not to like it. There's something wrong with it. But poetry, the way Whitman did it, was of the soul. He didn't go to, you know... he didn't view writing poetry as an art form to perfect. He viewed it as simply the natural expression in language of the experiences of soul. So that's why, to me, he's become really important.
Hmm.
He's a great encourager, you know.
No, he is. I mean, he's one of my favorite poets.
Yeah. Well, you're a soulful dude. You know what I mean.
I'd be remiss if I didn't kind of throw this in and think about this, but... because even though I've read most of the book, I haven't finished it, and we haven't talked about your book, Burnt Books, yet.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure.
So here you have Whitman.
Yeah.
This very soulful character.
Right.
Who really isn't from the bottom.
Right.
In many ways. You know, I mean, but Kafka is.
Yeah.
In the way he looks at the world.
Right.
But you also love Kafka.
Right.
And teach courses in Kafka, not just here, but in Czechoslovakia, right?
Yeah.
Well, in Czech.
Yeah. Yeah, the Czech Republic. Right. I did. Yeah.
Oh, you did. Right. So
no more.
So you did.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a different journey for you, Kafka, that led you to.
No, not really. I mean, to me, Kafka was a person who, and Kafka and Rabbi Nachman were both people who, you know, went through the journey to the bottom and then rose back up to the top. And the proposition in the book is that, you know, Kafka, who lived 100 years after Rabbi Nachman and about 1,000 kilometers apart, they both wrote mystical tales. They both died of tuberculosis at a very early age, 38 and 41, and they both asked their best friends to burn their books. So,
right.
So that's
right.
The premise. That's how I lure you into the book.
Right.
That's my
right.
plan. But the real deal is about the idea that many mystical traditions have, but the way the particular Jewish tradition, which we call Hasidism, puts it is the descent for the sake of the ascent, the going down for the sake of coming up. So the idea there that Kafka experienced in secular terms and Rabbi Nachman experienced in with the rich language of Hasidic psychology, very similar. And that is, to take the secular first, Kafka would write at night. So it's already kind of a dream space, oniric space, we'd call. And he would go down. He's a person who suffered a great deal from cycling through despair. He constantly touched down into despair. And then from that place, he would ascend. And he pictured himself as taking the ordinary facts of his life and as if passing through a great fire. And the great fire was this alchemical transformative thing which turned his ground horizontal situation to a vertical, really. So, for instance, you know, the first story that we know, the judgment, is about a father who tells his son to kill himself. And clearly reflects Kafka's tortured relationship to his father, but it got transformed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where he first discovered the secret of this going to the bottom of the feeling and then rising up. So the descent for the sake of the ascent. You have to touch bottom. You have to touch on your trauma to experience your joy. And Rabbi Nachman did it in his own way, you know, and he would have these moments where he literally would say, I don't know anything. I can't teach you today. You know, his followers are always eager to learn from him, and he would be like, I can say nothing. And they say, oh, Rabbi, sure. And he says, no, I really mean it, nothing. And then from that place of nothing, he would rise up and give the most beautiful teachings. So the sense of this, you have to touch on the deepest pain to get up to the greatest joy, something Kafka knows and something Rabbi Nachman knows, and it's really something they both show us. And that's probably the – you don't have to read the book now. I mean, that's basically the gist of the book.
I do have to finish the book.
No. Well, feel free. But I'm just saying, just to anyone listening, that the gist of what I was trying to get at was how both of these men, one secular, one religious, explored the same journey and framed it differently. And how in a certain way Kafka's framing of it, even though Kafka comes after, was less complete than Rabbi Nachman's. So that in a certain way Kafka asks a question that Rabbi Nachman answers, which is preposterous since Kafka came 100 years later, but I believe it's true.
You want to share what that question is?
The question of despair.
That's the question.
Yeah, in other words, because for Rabbi Nachman, despair was simply a moment in the journey to a greater sense of connection. You almost had to experience the loss of connection to experience the yearning for it. Kafka was never quite sure. I mean, another way of putting that is if Rabbi Nachman, who felt his mission was a failure, who wrote these tales in a desperate attempt to wake people up, he wrote these wonderful tales like The Lost Princess and The Seven Beggars and, you know, all these
fairy tales he wrote.
In some ways. Kabbalah or mysticism clothed in fairy tales.
Right.
He was a contemporary of the Brothers Grimm, so he's writing these fairy tales and they go really deep because we know they go deep. And of course, Kafka's writing, that's what really first got me onto this, because Kafka and Nachman has a tale which is called The Wise Man and the King, which is the same story as The Trial.
By Kafka.
Yeah. In The Trial, Joseph K. is arrested. We don't know for what he did, and he keeps trying to find the court of appeal where he can sort of explain himself, and he never really can, and then he's executed at the end. Very dark story.
Right.
Rabbi Nachman tells a story of a wise man who wants to get a picture of a king. So he goes to a country and realizes the country of the king is full of liars and cheats and jokers, you know, which is sort of the question of, you know, how could a good and wonderful, true God create a world full of all this pain and suffering? So he decides on a strategy. He gets himself involved in a legal battle, figuring, and at each level, the courts are corrupt and he gets a judgment against him. So he goes to the next level. He figures he'll go all the way to the top and appeal to the king himself. And that's how he gets a portrait of the king. So you see the similarity. That's what kind of intrigued me, that both use this idea of injustice in the world. Like, how can the world be so unjust and yet be created by a just God, if you want to frame it in purely religious terms?
And I was also thinking that you're discovering Nachman.
Yeah.
It's not somebody you're really totally familiar with. You right. found him through your love of Kafka,
yeah.
right?
Right.
There's Rabbi Nachman, who's the great-grandson of Baal Shem Tov, who founded Hasidism.
Right.
Are the people who actually, back in that period at any rate,
right.
brought the joy back in Judaism.
Right.
Brought the soul back in.
Right.
Brought
Correct.
The dance back in.
Correct.
Brought the spirit back in.
That's right. Well, this is the thing that, and that's what's, you know, to discover the soul in dream work is to be liberated from expertise. I've always been liberated.
That's a good line. I like that. You know, that's good. That's
I've
good.
Always been liberated. You know, look at me. I write all these books that I'm not supposed to write. You know, with this Kafka book, I got attacked by, you know, all, of course, there's a Kafka industry. All the scholars said, no, he's got it wrong. And, you know, all the religious study uptight professors say, oh, what's he writing? He's trespassing on our territory. The secularists attack me. He's talking about the soul. He's an idiot. So everybody's attacking me. I was attacked in commentary. You know, it's right-wing
Jewish magazine.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I was attacked by Jewish Currents, which is a secularist Jewish
magazine. Left-wing Jewish magazine.
Yeah, right. It's like, I must be doing something right. You know, if everybody's attacking me. It's the first time I've been attacked, because up to now I've been kissing everybody's butt. But I guess now it's like, you know, the word's out, you know? So it's great. And I mean, it's painful. Believe me, it hurts. But it's like, in a way, it's great, too. So to be attacked, to realize that you're pushing people's buttons. So I'm not an expert. That's my great – you know, you don't have to be an – you know, Rabbi Nachman, you mentioned that he was he made tales. He wrote great tales. He gave traditional Hasidic teachings, books of them. He died at 38. He made up nigunim, songs, mystical songs that we still sing. And so he's a singer. And they say – of course, we've never seen it – that – oh, you never saw anything if you never saw him dance. That the way he danced was just so beautiful. So you understand that, whereas the way we look at it in our horizontal, sort of like, well, you have to study dancing, or you know, if you want to be a musician, you have to take music lessons. You want to be a writer, you have to go to poet school, you know. Look at Whitman. He didn't go to poet school. He wrote poetry, you know. So we're completely have lost that sense of joy and like exploration and being able to make mistakes and be an idiot. Like, I'm an idiot. You know, what? I have no right to talk to people. I don't have a degree in psychology. I mean, who am I to do it? You
who
know?
Needs one, though?
Well, some people maybe do need it. I'm not putting anyone down. I'm just saying that we've gotten so locked into that idea. Like, probably doing what you do, I don't know how you got into it.
It's an accident.
Exactly. I had that. I kind of smelled that, you know, like
complete accident.
Because you're bringing something to that, right? So you didn't do it as like, oh, like imagine a young Mark Steiner now, like saying, well, how do I become Mark Steiner? Well, I guess I'll have to go to school and, you know.
Right.
You know?
No,
you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So finally, at this point in my life, I'm finally free of expertise, you know.
I love it. Roger Cammons, I want to say it's just been a joy to see you again and have you in the studio. Thank you so much, brother, for being here.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's great.
And we'll have all his books online. You can at steinershow.org, History of the Last Dream, the Burnt Books, June the Lotus, his other poetry books that he's written, and his website as well. And thank you for coming back to Baltimore.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, public radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.